fun.
Okay.
And it's working just fine. We had a lot of the major biographical information you told me about where you're from and stuff before. One question I didn't ask is, when were you born?
1920, October 2nd.
1920. And the other question I didn't ask before is, how did you meet your wife and when did you get married?
All right. Barbara and I, Barbara was my secretary. She's my second wife.
Oh, okay.
And we got married in, by May 6th, she'll be married, won't she? In 1972, we married in January 12th, 1972.
I can't ever remember that.
I don't know.
And just, was your first wife Norma Shell?
Norma was my first wife.
Okay, okay. Mm-hmm. All right, because I'd seen her name before. As
yes,
well.
Now Norma and I married in 1944.
In
1944. And we married in September. I remember that. Mm-hmm. September 11th.
I see.
1944, and we married it while I was still in law school at Ann Arbor.
Yeah.
And I met her there.
And you met her
yes,
there.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And she's passed away now?
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. So Norma's the mother of Deanna and Carol and Benita and Ben.
Ben, okay.
Right.
Okay. And one other quick question, listener. Did you live in Louisville at any time before you went to law school? Or
no,
before?
I used to come back and forth to Louisville, and I knew Louisvillians, and I had relatives here.
Okay.
But I had never lived in Louisville.
You had never lived here before you arrived.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, when we talked the first time, you told me a little bit about your parents and your father's position stories about moving around with him and stuff. Mm-hmm. One thing I was wondering about is when you were growing up, what did they teach you about how to respond to racial prejudice?
I'm sure that I was sheltered because my own recollection is that we generally stayed to ourselves a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And in the mountain town of Middlesboro where we lived, it was very easy not to come in contact with too many whites, mm-hmm. except when you went to downtown to buy something or something of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
I spent more time running through those mountains with other kids and occasionally with some white kids who I had no problems with, and they had no problems with me, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a little different attitude about race up in the mountains of Kentucky. Most of those people were on the same economic level.
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't the competition between the races that you might find in some other areas of Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
In the metropolitan areas, nor in western Kentucky, where slavery existed a much longer period of time than it...
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it ever happened up in the mountains of Kentucky.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And my father was such a well-respected man in the town.
Mm-hmm.
He was like the black mayor, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't recall any special problems.
Mm-hmm. When do you think you first encountered racism or racial prejudice?
Well, I think I encountered some, of course, in Middlesboro. I'm not saying that I didn't encounter any.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I can't remember that I was ever affected by it in any way, except that I would wonder occasionally why people would look at me the way they did. You know, there used to be a look blacks used to think of it as the hate look that some whites would look at blacks at, as though they just really hated them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of a happy-go-lucky fella, and it seems to me that I felt that.
Mm-hmm.
It bothered me when I would see something of that nature because I was friendly and communicative and talkative, and I guess people didn't really want to hear me.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, I had a real pleasant childhood, and I can't remember that I felt real discrimination, I guess, I came to college.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then I began to experience it, not because it was so prevalent on a campus at Kentucky State because we were an all-black school, but because of our relationship with other schools. And I got involved in matters where we were involved in matters with particularly say the YMCA, and in the YMCA program, we've been involved with students from the University of Kentucky. And I know that as I went to school at Kentucky State, I wanted somehow to be able to go to the University of Kentucky for graduate school or to go to law school or something of that nature. I really wanted to go to graduate school because I thought I was going to be a teacher. My parents were teachers, and that was it looked like my future. Then I began to see the crosses that were burned around on the hills of Frankfort. And I don't remember anything like that happening as I grew up in the mountains of Kentucky. But the crosses were burned around on the hillsides, and we could see them from the looking out, you know, from the campus. Then I saw the Klan march downtown in downtown Frankfort. And it these were things that, which were really just like a slap in the face, you know, a real slap in the face. And we were, even at that school, they had a paternalistic attitude toward us and tried to keep us from being involved in anything downtown, just stay on the campus. And but we had to go town. We'd go town, go to the movie, sit in the crow's nest. But we, but we had to go to town to see the movie, or to make some purchases that we couldn't get on the campus. And we recognized that the campus authorities really didn't want us to be involved too much with the town people. And the town people, I guess, didn't want to be involved too much with us. So, except, say, on a football day when Kentucky State had great football teams back in those days, and of course everybody came, white and black, to see them play. Yeah. In 1936, which is a year before I went there, the team was a black college national champion. And they were in 1934 as well, 34 and 36. So in the years that I was there, they had a good team. They just didn't have a national championship team.
Well, and white and black both went to those games. Were the seating, was the seating segregated in the games or integrated in the games?
No, it was integrated. Integrated seating.
And never any reaction to that?
I don't remember any reaction at all.
That's interesting. Is that because it was on a black college?
I would think so. I would think so. I don't know what might have happened otherwise, but of course. And the whites came to our basketball games as well, but not as many. They came to the football games particularly because we really had a good team.
Basketball not so good?
Basketball not so good.
Were you aware of anyone either at the school or in the city trying to fight some of the segregation that early?
I was on the Kentucky State debating team, and one of our professors that we felt was trying to make some inroads into trying to get things to be better between the races was Professor Cheney. I don't know whether you've heard of him or not. Cheney is still alive, and he affected a lot of us. We thought he was one of the greatest teachers in the world. He also was the faculty advisor for our debating team. And I spent a lot of time with him, and he was a, in fact, he was a graduate of the University of Michigan where I went to law school, and we talked back and forth about several things. Cheney was quite interested in trying to make things better, but not through any marching or, as far as I know, filing of any lawsuits or anything of that nature. He was a the conversationalists who wanted to increase the dialogue between whites and blacks. And over the years, I think he has lectured at the University of Kentucky as well as at Kentucky State. And he himself was, I think he's recognized in Kentucky as one of the great history teachers in Kentucky.
He was a history teacher?
Yes. Cheney has a wealth of knowledge. I don't know whether his memory is still as good because he's older than I am. Of course, that puts him up there. Since I'll be 79, you know, in October. Yeah, I'll be 79 October 2nd. That's why I said to you I may not remember dates and things.
So. That's okay. It's okay. You're doing pretty well so far.
Okay. You know, I was asked that question when they were talking. Whitney Young Jr. was my classmate and my roommate.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I was asked the question by Dr. Wise, I believe is her name, from Princeton, who wrote a book on the life of Whitney Young.
Mm-hmm.
Asked me whether he had shown some tendencies at Kentucky State to fight the racial question.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to think of it, and I can't remember any such thing. We went to school, we had a good time. We
mm-hmm.
we all
mm-hmm.
Thought we had the greatest class in the world, and most of us went to graduate school somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And or to a professional school of some type.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember any bad instances of racial prejudice. Mm-hmm. That's why I try to get that. When I went to the University of Michigan,
mm-hmm.
I felt that there were occasions when I knew the answer to a question and I tried to speak and I was ignored. I felt that.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Maybe I had a little chip on my shoulder, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I try to rationalize some of these things.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't remember having particular problems there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember. I had plenty of white friends there.
Mm-hmm.
So I really don't remember.
Okay.
My life wasn't full of a lot of
yeah.
racial problems.
Yeah. Well, why did you come back to Louisville?
Kentucky,
I should say.
Yes,
like,
okay.
Yeah.
I knew Charles W. Anderson, Jr., and he
mm-hmm.
he was, of course, the Mr. Black Politico of the New South.
Oh, yeah? Mm-hmm.
And the first black state legislator in the South.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And a good lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend of my family.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked him.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to come back to practice with him.
Okay.
Then he really began to initiate some of these things that I got subsequently involved in
mm-hmm.
Because it was obvious to me when I came back here that I wasn't in the same place I was in when I was at Michigan. Even at the courthouse seemed to be segregated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, blacks sat in one section, whites in another,
mm-hmm.
both in the old police court. I was starting to say the district court. Wasn't in the district court then.
Mm-hmm.
In the old police court and in the criminal divisions of the circuit court and in the civil divisions of the court, there was segregated seating. And I never was quite able to understand it because there was not an obvious division. No, there wasn't a Rio here and everybody black sits
mm-hmm.
back here and everybody
mm-hmm.
white sits up
mm-hmm.
there.
Mm-hmm.
It just seemed to be a natural division for
mm-hmm.
some reason.
Mm-hmm.
And there were one or two people who began to protest that particular Bishop Tucker. I don't know whether you...
Yeah, I've come across the name. Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Bishop Tucker, who led some of these civil rights fights back in the
mm-hmm.
in the 40s, in the late 40s and early 50s. In fact, I believe you probably have seen some picture of him integrating the bus station.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Together with George Burney.
Mm-hmm. No, George Burney's name I haven't heard before.
Oh, George. Yeah, George.
Yeah, who's that?
George Burney is the fellow who still has the Martin Luther Day, Martin Luther King Day, what do you call it now? I'm trying to think of what it is. Oh, celebration,
yeah.
You know, memorials and the, when the cars go up and down the road, what do you call
like
it?
Like a rally or a car
rally?
Parade or something?
Yeah, they have a parade
yeah.
every
Oh, really?
Yeah, George Burney uh-huh. has an organization, he calls it Pride.
Okay.
And with Pride, he sponsors the Martin Luther King Day parade and programs.
Oh, okay.
And he also, his organization has a Christmas party for kids and
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing. They do mm-hmm. a pretty good job, but George is a very visible character around.
Sounds like someone I should interview.
You probably
yeah.
should. He's in Seattle right now, but he'll be
okay.
back shortly.
And he was around with Bishop Tucker way back
yes.
in the, okay.
Yes, George, in fact, George and Bishop Tucker are the two blacks on the picture which
Okay.
You might see. I don't know whether you've seen
it or not. Yeah, it's in the Kentucky Black Heritage book.
The little black fellow is George Burney.
Tucker.
George is 72, so he's...
Okay. Well, I'll definitely try to look him up.
George won't be back until... His wife lives in Seattle. He lives here. He stays here until about this time of year, and he'll stay in Seattle until December, probably.
Oh, so I can't get you for a while.
It'll be around December.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. What was Louisville like? You were talking about the courtrooms, but outside the courtrooms, what was Louisville like when you moved here?
Oh, very segregated city. You know, blacks didn't come below about 26th Street,
mm-hmm.
and didn't go, this whole West End was, of course, white below mm-hmm. 26th Street.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you remember the old Buchanan versus Worley case, where actually segregation was a matter of fact in this city,
mm-hmm.
Except on public buses,
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
which weren't segregated or anything.
Mm-hmm.
The bus
mm-hmm.
system...
Mm-hmm.
Well, I that was an unusual thing. Except
mm-hmm.
for that bus system, everything just was a segregated city.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
I know you got here right after the war, but do you know if World War II had had any effect on any of that at all?
not as much as some of the other cities where perhaps more of the returning veterans stopped.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about Whitney Young, for example. He didn't come back here, even
mm-hmm.
though this was his area. He left this area,
mm-hmm.
and he had developed some feeling for fighting for racial justice while
mm-hmm.
he was in the service, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't come back to Louisville.
Mm-hmm.
He came, I think, to Omaha, Nebraska, is where he went,
mm-hmm.
and subsequently down to Atlanta or somewhere. A lot of... The other returning veterans didn't come back to Louisville. They stopped in other cities.
Yeah.
I guess they felt they had better opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And so we didn't feel that so much.
Oh, that's interesting.
We didn't feel that so much.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, Fort Knox was right out here, and we had soldiers coming in here a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But they were hustled in and out of town, believe me.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they were.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. Protected, I think,
mm-hmm.
you know, against themselves and against town people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The early 40s, let's see, I got here in 1946, 47, 46,
mm-hmm.
uh-huh. and in those days, the NAACP was a pretty strong organization around here.
Mm-hmm.
So were political clubs. There was a black Democratic club, and there was a Third Ward Democratic, Republican club, they called it. But it had people who were involved in trying to change things politically, like Charlie Anderson,
mm-hmm.
and like Jesse Waters. I don't know whether you've heard of Jesse Waters.
Mm-mm.
He's was given a pretty good spot in the housing area
mm-hmm.
Through Marlo Cook.
Okay.
Like Joe Ray, who was you've heard of Joe Ray,
mm-hmm.
who was a real estate man.
Mm-hmm.
And all these people were, and the NAACP had, with the lawyers who were involved, like James Crumlin,
mm-hmm.
and Alfred Carroll.
Mm-hmm.
And Carroll and Crumlin filed some of the first lawsuits which were filed around here. I joined them.
Mm-hmm.
They had already, for example, the Sweeney case that,
mm-hmm.
Against the city of Louisville to open up the public parks.
Mm-hmm.
Carroll and Crumlin had filed that action. The NAACP asked me to join them. See, I'm supposed to be the sharp little new man on the block. So
mm-hmm.
they
mm-hmm.
asked me to join to help them.
Okay.
And since that time, since I became so active in it, that I got more publicity out of it than they did. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. Because I was the active mover in that case and in the Lyman Johnson case, except for the fact that, of course, I could not move beyond the Thurgood Marshalls and those folks who came down from New York and mm-hmm. Washington.
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I was local counsel in the Lyman Johnson case, too. Lyman Johnson versus the University of Kentucky.
Could I ask you to tell me a little bit more about, I guess I want to hear about both the NAACP, but first maybe those black political clubs, what kinds of things do they do?
Okay, the Third Ward Republican Club was composed largely of precinct captains and the legislative district chairman mm-hmm. in the black areas.
Mm-hmm.
They also would call upon any people who had political jobs who happened to be members of that particular party.
Mm-hmm.
And they met monthly. They would meet monthly and discuss what areas they thought they could help themselves in.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
mm-hmm.
politically, and they weren't part of this filing lawsuits and so forth. They were just people who thought they could prevail upon the mayor or prevail upon the county judge or prevail upon the people in charge of the main political parties, you know, like
mm-hmm.
We had political bosses back in those days. I remember the Democratic Party particularly had strong political bosses and they
mm-hmm.
ran everything.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny Crimmins and Miss Lenny McLaughlin, if you've heard the name.
I've heard the name Crimmins. Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Miss Lenny could tell you if you asked her for something, she said she'd do it. And that was it. And mm-hmm. she called this judge, that...
Now, is that person
mayor.
White or black, Lenny?
White.
White. Okay.
White.
His glasses were all white.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
But the clubs, the black clubs,
mm-hmm.
would try to impress upon people in that position, like Miss Lenny and... Johnny Crimmins,
mm-hmm.
Their need for whatever, you know, jobs or opportunities, business
mm-hmm.
opportunities
mm-hmm.
that could be advanced and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
They were pretty active. The Republican Club, I'm sure, was started by Charles Anderson. And that club propelled him into the state legislature.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, there always were the votes in that legislative district, but they'd
mm-hmm.
never elected a black legislator before.
Mm-hmm.
But Charlie organized it.
Mm-hmm.
And as the organizer, he soon became its leader, and they elected him to the state legislature.
Mm-hmm.
After that, he kept it alive.
Mm-hmm.
I knew more about that Republican club at the time than I knew about what the Democrats were doing, because
mm-hmm.
I was... not political at the time. I was simply around here trying to practice law. That
mm-hmm.
was my
okay.
idea at first.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But I realized after a while that it could help
mm-hmm.
to
mm-hmm.
be involved
mm-hmm.
as a politician.
Mm-hmm.
And once I started, I couldn't stop.
And were you a Republican or a Democrat?
I was a Republican then. I changed to and became a Democrat.
Okay. And when did that happen?
Let's see. I was a Republican when Harry Truman beat Dewey.
Mm-hmm.
But right after that, I became, and when was that, you know?
Well, that was 48.
48.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it must have been right after that, about 50 or something like that, I became a Democrat.
Okay. I think I remember reading in the Defender, a few articles about a group of black leaders switching parties because of being disgruntled with
yes.
one. Was that, were you in that group?
No.
Okay.
No, I wasn't really in that group.
Mm-hmm.
I probably should have been.
Mm-hmm.
But that was when that was about housing.
Okay.
Yeah, it was the housing was the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And the then mayor was Mayor Farnsley.
Okay.
And the issue was a fair housing ordinance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mayor Farnsley had said, no, it was not Farnsley.
No, it was open housing. That would have been...
It wasn't Farnsley. It was...
Calgar, then Schmid?
Yes, on the Republican side. They were elected on those issues.
Right.
Calgary said that if the Board of Aldermen passed the housing ordinance, he would support it.
Okay.
And that got all the black vote.
Okay.
The Democratic candidate at the time said under no circumstances would he support it or would he sign it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when there was a shift of some of the black leaders from the Democratic Party into the Republican Party, who supported the Calgary and Cook and I guess that's Calgary Cook and Louis Nunn at the time, who was the governor.
Okay, so that's much later than you switched, because that's in the 60s.
Yes, I'm trying to remember when it was exactly.
Yeah. One last question about these political clubs. You said that people were working through political means, pressuring the different political leaders and stuff. Were they trying to work to improve conditions within segregation, or were they trying to get rid of segregation?
Well, I think they were really trying to improve conditions within segregation.
Mm-hmm.
There was not a big effort to get rid of segregation at that time.
Okay.
And I don't know when that push came.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Looks like all of a sudden it was just here.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think people like individuals like Bishop Tucker and mm-hmm. George Birney and James Crumlin
mm-hmm.
did more toward pushing to rid the city of segregation directly. And Alfred Carroll.
Mm-hmm. So the lawyers.
The lawyer, mm-hmm. and subsequently mm-hmm. Ben Shope.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I joined them.
Are you a little younger than?
I'm younger than Carroll and younger than Crumlin.
I'm interviewing Crumlin next week.
Uh-huh. Crumlin's about 80, I did know, I think he's 83.
So you're sort of a little bit of a generation behind.
Right.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
not quite, but, okay.
But we came here almost, they were here about 2 years before I came.
Mm-hmm.
And
already established.
Already established, right.
Mm-hmm. One other set of questions before we get into more of your personal story is about the NAACP at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You said it was very active and very strong. Could you tell me a little bit about it when you first arrived?
Yes.
In the city?
Yes, the lawyers were heading the NAACP at the time. It was fellows like Carroll, Alfred Carroll and James Crumlin,
mm-hmm.
and some of the educators like Dr. C.H. Parrish,
mm-hmm.
and a few of the ministers, local ministers, who were very active as NAACP mm-hmm. members. And we don't see that anymore, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see it now. I guess they don't think we have the problem we used to have.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But so we had the support of the larger black churches,
mm-hmm.
and they helped to fund whatever programs we needed to, mm-hmm. to fund.
Which churches would those have been?
Quinn Chapel, mm-hmm. AME Zion Church, mm-hmm. of the Zion Baptist Church
mm-hmm.
at 22nd and Ali,
mm-hmm.
Muhammad Ali.
Mm-hmm.
Not the big churches of today, because they didn't exist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And one at 18th and Chestnut, where Mackie Daniels is now, but not where he was not there then.
Right, he wasn't there until much later. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So those were the leaders. Who's in the membership? Who's the regular rank and file membership?
Rank and file membership. Yeah. With school teachers, black school teachers, black largely black professionals.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. We did have others, but black professionals and black mm-hmm. and black poll workers.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
And of course that would include the job holders, black job holders.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Let me turn this on. So that's people with political jobs and other
things.
Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, I think the membership was much stronger, much larger than it ever has been since those days, mm-hmm. when really there was something, I guess, that people felt they had to accomplish
mm-hmm.
that they don't really feel as strong about today as they did then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
With the walls of segregation torn down.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a question more or less of individuals trying to accomplish something on their own.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
even though the NAACP still exists and is mm-hmm. needed.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
So, well, there were some other ministers and other folks, but I think I named the ones that were important to me.
Mm-hmm. What kinds of things was it doing at the time?
Okay, they were attacking more than one front.
Mm-hmm.
We were concerned about public housing, of course, and in to eliminate segregation in housing.
Mm-hmm.
We were concerned about education. We were more thinking in terms not so much of the whole school system then as we were thinking about in terms of higher education.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to integrate the
mm-hmm.
institutions of higher education. The other schools came later.
Mm-hmm.
We were concerned that we had political movements too. We were concerned that we had candidates, you know, to run for public office who would support the integration of all facilities.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, we're housing, education, politics, job opportunity, but that was the Urban League did more on that along those lines than the NAACP did, but the NAACP was concerned about
mm-hmm.
housing opportunity,
mm-hmm.
I mean job opportunities.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And now what did they do? We met. We talked.
Uh-huh.
Occasionally we prepared a lawsuit,
mm-hmm.
you know, and we filed some lawsuits. We would also try to bring in the national offices of NAACP for support.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We held seminars and brought in speakers.
Really?
Yes.
What kind of speakers?
Some who would talk to us about what's being done on the national scene. I remember we had, what's that man's name? Archibald Cochran, who was he was in the federal government now. What was he?
I remember the name.
I remember it so well. I'm saying now, I'm calling it off just like I ought to know exactly what he did. And I should. I think he was in the Labor Department.
Mm-hmm.
We had Archibald Cochran. We had, we used to get, I can remember Thurgood Marshall being here several times. I don't know why
mm-hmm.
he was here. I know he was here on our cases and so forth, but
mm-hmm.
I think he was here otherwise too, just to talk strategy. And,
mm-hmm.
and Roy Wilkins was here
mm-hmm.
occasionally.
How was the attendance at these meetings when they had speakers?
Oh, very good.
Yeah?
Very good,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We had substantial participation.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But after the meeting, a lot of times nothing happened, you know.
Mm-hmm. 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 Mm-hmm.
And I think we were sort of waiting. Everybody was waiting for somebody else to take the lead.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And of course, any time you start something, you have to have some money. And getting money was one thing we always had a problem with.
Oh, really?
Trying to raise money.
Mm-hmm.
How
would you raise money?
Usually through the churches.
Oh, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm.
Yeah, through the churches. That was a big source of
mm-hmm.
support.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like a special offering type
yeah,
thing?
Yeah, special offering.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of that sort of thing, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was the best way we had to raise money. Membership drives. Too much with membership drives because
mm-hmm.
membership is cheap.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. Yeah, it was $2 or something.
Oh, that's all. Yeah,
yeah.
You had to have
mm-hmm.
members, but
mm-hmm.
it was so cheap that you couldn't run a program with it.
Right, right, right. Yeah. No, I've read membership lists, actually,
mm-hmm.
from the 30s and 40s.
Yeah, yeah.
See how cheap it was.
That's it.
Yeah, yeah. So, how do you get involved in all this?
Came down, person. How did I happen to start?
How did you happen to start getting involved in these NAACP?
Okay, I guess it's because when I came back to Louisville, I went in the law office of Charles W. Anderson, Jr.
Mm-hmm.
And he was already active.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with Charlie already active, and I just naturally fell into it, I think,
mm-hmm.
and then became quite interested after falling into it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I was that concerned as I was up in Michigan, going to law school, and
mm-hmm.
concerned more with getting out of law school than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I was thinking too much about anything else until I got down here and
mm-hmm.
got in the office with Anderson,
mm-hmm.
and he was wrapped up in both the political
mm-hmm.
area and in the racial justice area.
Mm-hmm.
And so it got me immediately involved. Then mm-hmm. I became friends with Crumlin and Alfred Carroll.
Mm-hmm.
They were younger than Anderson, but a little older than I am, so
mm-hmm.
I was a young guy on the block.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
And started attending meetings and meeting others who were involved, like Lyman Johnson, and who I knew because Johnson had come to Michigan in graduate school while I was in law school up there. We'd met.
Oh, so you had met
him
there.
I had met him there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But getting, you know, closer to Lyman
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
to Joel Ray and
mm-hmm.
I people. Just got me involved. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, they're telling me that you got to do this for us, and I said, okay, I'm here.
So how did, what kind, could you tell me about some of the cases that you worked on then?
Yeah, well, you know about the, you know, the case Lyman Johnson versus University of Kentucky.
That's one of the big ones. That's 4950 in there?
It's before 54, so
I believe I'll double check, but I think it's right around there.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay,
so what happened with that?
Sweeney versus the City of Louisville, the
mm-hmm.
Park
mm-hmm.
case.
Mm-hmm.
That's also my I was supposed to be the local counsel with Crumlin, and Carroll also assisted me in those and in the University of Kentucky case.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the two big ones, really, because we spent a lot of time on both those cases.
Yeah. Well, the Park case seems very, it's in the Defender almost every week. You know, when you're reading the Defender through this time period, there's a mention of the Park cases almost every week
mm-hmm.
on what was going on. So it seems fairly complicated. Could you explain maybe the legal strategy there?
Sure. We started in the state courts. We hoped we could...
Mm-hmm.
We could accomplish what we wanted to accomplish in the state courts.
Mm-hmm.
So the lawsuit was filed in the Jefferson Circuit Court to eliminate segregation. Not to eliminate segregation, because we didn't do it that way. We talked about discrimination,
mm-hmm.
that the City of Louisville has these facilities for people generally. They have certain parks set aside for blacks and certain parks for whites. The parks for whites contain so much more that you can't find in the black parks, such as a fishing lake, such as a golf course, such
mm-hmm.
as a park, theatrical association,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, out at Iroquois Park,
mm-hmm.
and some certain facilities which Chickasaw Park simply didn't have, and that's the sole park set aside for the use by blacks.
Mm-hmm.
Chickasaw Park didn't have these facilities,
mm-hmm.
and so we could go at it directly on the basis of a discrimination
mm-hmm.
that my tax dollars are being paid as anybody else's tax dollars, but you discriminate against me because you're making available to white citizens things you're not making available to blacks.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't talking about segregation, eliminating segregation. We were talking strictly about a discrimination.
Why not?
Well, because Plessy versus Ferguson stood in our way.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And we understood that Plessy versus Ferguson stood in our way, and we didn't expect a Kentucky court to change
okay.
Plessy versus Ferguson.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But we threw it in. Now,
mm-hmm.
you find that's part of our, we always threw it in, even though we didn't expect to win on it.
Mm-hmm.
We always threw in the fact we said segregation in and of itself is illegal, is
mm-hmm.
unconstitutional. We throw
mm-hmm.
that in.
Mm-hmm.
But we never did develop a strategy to win on that point. We
mm-hmm.
couldn't get by Plessy versus Ferguson, and no
mm-hmm.
state court was going to handle it, but the state of Kentucky,
mm-hmm.
they weren't going to handle it.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
say the Plessy versus Ferguson federal decision was wrong. They're not
mm-hmm.
going to say that.
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Even though states had the right
mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. to give their citizens more protection
mm-hmm.
if they chose to.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have, they were not bound. They couldn't take give any less
mm-hmm.
than the federal Constitution provided, but they mm-hmm. could give more.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we didn't expect them to, but we
mm-hmm.
throw it in anyway.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
And until the Brown versus Board of Education, when they really organized and got the expert witnesses
mm-hmm.
to testify about the effects of segregation
mm-hmm.
and to prove that segregation in and of itself was a discrimination, then, and we didn't have that kind of evidence
mm-hmm.
to present.
Mm-hmm.
So we
mm-hmm.
just, they took the broad sweep. We just discriminated against because you got something out here that we don't have. And we want part of what you have.
Mm-hmm.
So on that basis, we went through the state courts. The reason you saw a lot of it was we didn't win in the state court.
Mm-hmm.
Went through the state court and then went back to the federal court.
Mm-hmm.
And then, see, when we went to federal court, the state wanted to argue, I mean, the lawyers for the city
mm-hmm.
wanted to argue. And, you can't do that. You have to appeal from the state court, the highest court in the state, to the Supreme Court of the United States. You can't branch off into the district court.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it just happened that case, there was a decision which said you could.
Okay.
Where civil rights were involved.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an issue that had been determined by the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, United States Court of Appeals.
Okay. Right around the same time?
No, it had been earlier.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
It wasn't from Kentucky. It wasn't
okay.
a case from Kentucky. I think it was...
You could just use that to argue this is why...
You could use it. Okay. It was the authority for
mm-hmm.
covering this matter in the United States District Court here.
Okay.
So mm-hmm. Judge Shelvin, who was the judge at the time
mm-hmm.
In the United States District Court, followed it right down the line.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Said, well, the burden of proof is upon the city to prove that you give equal facilities. If you say it's separate but equal, prove
mm-hmm.
to
mm-hmm.
that Chickasaw Park is equal to Iroquois and Cherokee. And and they couldn't, of
right.
course.
Yeah, yeah. They couldn't.
So naturally, we won that case real handily.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But even what is little known is that Judge Shelvin did not include in his order the Louisville Park Theatrical Association. He did not include
mm-hmm.
The programs presented out at Iroquois. He separated that somehow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But when they appealed this matter to the United States Court of Appeals in Cincinnati,
mm-hmm.
we got it all.
Oh, yeah? Oh, really? From the court?
Yes.
Okay.
Got it all.
Okay.
Oh, in fact, Judge Shelvin ruled in our favor, but he
mm-hmm.
didn't rule in our favor on the park theatrical.
Right.
On
the Iroquois amphitheater.
Yeah, he said, use the parks, but you said, this is, the amphitheater is run by a private organization, he says.
Mm-hmm.
But it might have been, but it's on public park.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I guess it was by a private group of people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that didn't keep it from having its public purpose
mm-hmm.
and being supported by public taxes and so forth. So therefore, Judge Shelvin, even though he wouldn't go that far,
mm-hmm.
he went as far, I guess, as he thought he ought to.
Mm-hmm.
But then Cincinnati, they carried us all the way.
They carried
us
the rest of the way. Were there any other, while you're doing this legal work, were there any other efforts going on to desegregate the parks? Any other groups or organizations working on it?
If there were, I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know of any that were.
Okay.
No.
One question I have is, it did seem to take a long time. Why?
It did
why
take
the parks?
A long time.
Why did the parks seem important to you all?
I think we were observing things nationally, and
mm-hmm.
it seemed to me that what we did was to take things that we thought we could handle
mm-hmm.
that were so obvious,
mm-hmm.
Where we could make an inroad without, you know, if we jumped on a separate education at the time, it might have been very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They really had to work hard to get all the evidence together to show that segregated schools were definitely inferior and so forth and so on. They had to have evidence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We didn't have to have too much evidence to show that Chickasaw Park has a fishing lake and all we had to do is go out there and see it. Or that Iroquois has a golf course, and we don't have any golf course in Chickasaw Park, you know.
Right.
All that sort of thing was, it was easy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess we were really taking an easy route. But at the same, and we were watching what was happening nationally with NAACP, how they were handling cases in other jurisdictions. And we said, we'll get around to education, but fortunately, after Brown versus Board of Education, it set things up for everybody, and we didn't have to do anything special, except that Jim Crumlin did have to see that it was implemented. Crumlin went, Crumlin traveled, have you ever interviewed him?
I'm going to next week.
I hope he'll be, he's getting a little senile, but Crumlin went throughout Kentucky. And he, to make sure that the education issues were settled, and that's what happened down at Sturgis, you remember that?
I've seen the newspaper articles.
Okay, so he was there, Sturgis and other areas of Kentucky where he became well known around Kentucky as a man who was seeing to it that segregation and education was abolished. Just a follow-up to Brown versus Board of Education.
Right.
But still, they were, it was resisted, you know.
I do want to, actually, I was going to ask some questions about the school stuff here, but before, I just want to make sure I have everything on the parks. So, you were basically doing it then because it was something you could do, if
yes,
possible.
Yes, it was. It seemed to be one of the, well, you say, why the parks? I actually, there was a demand for the use of golfing facilities. We had no golf course, for example. There were blacks who went to Fort Knox to play golf. There were blacks who traveled to other areas to play golf, and because they couldn't play in Louisville. I guess that's the big example. Of course, there was no similar entertainment to that presented at the Louisville amphitheater, the Park Theatrical Association's amphitheater. So there were no similar places for blacks. In area alone, of course, those parks were
much bigger,
much larger.
Yeah.
Shawnee had, I believe, a baseball diamonds. Chickasaw didn't have the area for baseball diamonds.
I've been down there. It's not a very big park.
Yes.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah.
Hey, they had nice tennis courts. That's what I was
thinking. Oh, yeah? Back then they did?
Yeah,
they
had nice tennis courts. In fact, they were probably as good as any in town back then.
Why do you think whites resisted integrated parks so much?
Well, I really blame it on the politicians. I don't think really that the people were as determined to maintain segregation as some of the city leaders at the time were. I think they felt that their political strength lay in continuing segregation, but I think they were wrong. I don't believe that people never gave us that kind of trouble. You know, you had the Ku Klux Klan to march at a time or two, but they had very few members. And when they started organizing the white citizens' councils in the South, we didn't have that much trouble around here with the white citizens' council trying to oppose integration. We didn't. And except for a little problem out Dixie Highway, and I can't remember, you may know what I'm talking about there, when schools were integrated.
I think it's on busing though, isn't it?
On busing, yeah. We had some problems then.
Yeah.
But that didn't last very long.
I haven't gotten to that yet because it's more recent.
Right.
So I haven't,
that's right.
I haven't gotten that far.
That's true.
But I have heard that from,
from
various people. Yeah.
Well, but I don't recall that there was any particular... I think it's just that Louisville's leadership felt that we were still the big old southern city and we needed the segregation of the races. And I think that's the position that position was not absolutely correct. I mm-hmm. think it was. I think it was a mistake.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
In all the relationships I knew between people around here, whites and blacks got along pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Your personal experience?
My personal experiences. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
they got along pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember any bad. I don't remember mm-hmm. any bad experiences. Really,
mm-hmm.
I wish I could tell you something.
Oh, oh,
I remember one up in the mountains of Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
But
that's not Louisville.
Uh-uh.
That's interesting. So when you're having, because I know that in the early part of the 50s, Louisville had a number of, you know, we integrated the public libraries, the parks, the amphitheater eventually.
Right.
What was the public reaction to these, or the media and the public reaction?
I think the media supported the moves toward integration everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And the general public, except for a few individuals, we had no, I don't remember any special problems.
Mm-hmm.
When I became judge of the old Louisville Police Court,
mm-hmm.
When I won that election, I remember some FBI agents came by and told me that some Ku Klux Klan members were going to be at our rally that we held afterwards, which was at the Galt House, and they were concerned about it, and some of the Klan members did come. A fellow named Boyd Smallwood used to be the head of the local Klan, I believe,
mm-hmm.
but he came up and congratulated me, and I remember that very well, that he came and and perhaps he had something else in mind, I don't know, but he came and congratulated me, and that's all he said, and he left.
When was that?
That's 19 years later, yeah. 1970. That's 1970.
Okay, so after
yeah.
you've done some other things.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll get to that.
We're going back now to, you were talking about the parks, weren't you?
Yeah, I was just wondering what the reaction was to, you know, when they do have these decisions, you know, these successes, you know, leading up to,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the early 50s.
And the way I remember it, we had no problems. Now, I do recall that there was some problems over here at Shawnee Park.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to remember when that was, because that problem... And I think that problem was caused by some black thugs.
Mm.
I'll just tell you the truth about it.
Mm.
Who came over and started trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they had to close down, what was it they had over here?
Fountain Ferry.
Closed down Fountain Ferry.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I that may have been both white and black thugs, I suppose, I might
mm-hmm.
say, put it that way. But I don't think that was the general population that caused that.
Yeah, I've read about that.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to ask about on this general subject is in your first interview you had mentioned that in a lot of the work you did in the 50s, there was, as you put it then, some good white people that you could work with.
Oh, absolutely.
Who? And how would you work with them?
Well, Frank Haddad is a good example. Mm-hmm. Frank and I were close over the years, and... he was always willing to give advice and to discuss a problem.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to think of the lawyers that night you mentioned. He became judge.
Triplett? No.
Henry Triplett didn't become judge, but Henry was always available. And
mm-hmm.
even though Henry was on the opposite side of some of our cases, but he was always... He was always available for friendship
mm-hmm.
and for conversation and for discussion about what the problems were.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying my best to think about... I tell you, my memory's going.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I might come back to you. Mm-hmm.
Maybe so.
Mm-hmm.
I can see them, but can't call their names. Isn't that something?
It's okay. There's people that
I
remember their names.
I liked Lorraine Mix, who was a judge of the criminal court at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Lorraine Mix was He seemed like to me he was head and shoulders above everybody else at the time.
Mm-hmm.
He was really there as an advisor and he used to be, I remember Judge Mix one time told me, you know, I was very unhappy about a jury verdict. And he said to me, he said, you ever stop to think that the jury might be right? He stopped me dead in my tracks. I used that once or twice myself since then.
So these are people in the legal system that
in
you were friendly
system.
With and could
yes,
talk
to go to
and
them and talk to and get mm-hmm. advice and mm-hmm. who supported the cause of integration.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Could you, what was the Lorraine Mix, that the spelling of that name? Do you have any idea?
M-I-X is his last name.
M-I-X.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Now, there was a Lorraine Mix Jr., but mm-hmm. I'm talking about the father.
Senior. Okay.
Lorraine Mix and Judge Mix died about... he probably died in the early 70s.
Okay. Just so I make sure I have people's names
so
spelled correctly.
Right.
Uh-huh.
That's Mix.
I had one question. There's a couple incidents that I just want to ask about. I once saw a reference to an issue involving the desegregation of U of L and Louisville Municipal College. Were you involved in that at all?
Yes.
Okay, could you
yes.
talk about your role here?
Well, we didn't really have to, we didn't really have to file a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
We prepared it.
Mm-hmm.
We were ready to file mm-hmm. the lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
And let me see what happened. We talked to... And I'll tell you who was active with us in that time, too, and who was a good white source. I say Father Tackall.
Charles?
Charles.
Yeah, I interviewed him.
Okay.
Yeah.
He was active with us in that matter.
Oh, really?
Yes, he was active.
Talk about that.
Yeah. And he also was active, did he tell you about his role in helping to integrate the Bar Association?
That's the next thing I want to ask you about.
Mm-hmm.
He did mention that, but I wanted to get your
yeah.
perspective on it, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. We were prepared. Mm-hmm. He was one who was really forward in both these matters, both with the Bar Association and with the Medical Association.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Medical Society was a Jefferson County Medical Society
mm-hmm.
headed by, the executive director was a man whose last name was Close, C-L-O-S-E.
Mm-hmm.
And our discussions were with, I think his first name was Gene, G-E-N-E, and I may be wrong there,
mm-hmm.
Close.
Mm-hmm.
And we prepared the lawsuit. We were ready to sue the Jefferson County Medical Society because black doctors could not belong to the Jefferson County Medical Society. Therefore, they could not practice in any of the hospitals
mm-hmm.
except for the Red Cross Hospital, which was the black segregated hospital out on Shelby Street.
Mm-hmm.
We were prepared to prove that all these hospitals were supported by public money, and that black doctors ought to be able to go into any of them. So we were getting our lawsuit ready,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they decided, once we had informed them of that we were going to do this, they decided that they would go ahead and
mm-hmm.
take action on their own, and they did.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They announced at all of the hospitals were open.
To black doctors?
To black doctors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Black, they were already open to black patients.
Really?
Some of them.
So that was after the...
After some of them had already been open to
okay.
black patients.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But now...
Oh, but now the black doctors would lose their patients, though.
That's right.
Right. Okay.
That's right.
Okay.
Now, all of them may not have been open to black patients.
Mm-hmm.
My memory isn't as perfect on that. I know
mm-hmm.
that... The university hospital, the city hospital had to be open to black patients, I'm sure of that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think the Jewish hospital was open to black patients.
Mm-hmm.
There was no
There was no day law that prohibited it, you know, as it did in education. That's one of the problems, you know, we had to overcome in education.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the Bar Association sort of followed suit because the newspaper wrote some articles about what the Medical Society had done, and I think it didn't take much for the Law Bar Association to follow suit after that.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, the Louisville Bar Association occupied and owned the Louisville Bar Library, mm-hmm. and there was no library facility equal to it for black lawyers. Black lawyers had their own little books, but mm-hmm. couldn't compete with the Louisville mm-hmm. Bar Association's law library. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have the facilities that we could use and couldn't belong to the Louisville Bar Association, even though we were members of the Kentucky Bar. Kentucky Bar, we had to be members of mm-hmm. Kentucky Bar, mm-hmm. but could not be members of Louisville Bar.
Okay.
Until the Louisville Bar decided that they could not be a private organization,
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
they, after the Medical Society mm-hmm. integrated, the Bar Association came along rapidly.
So you didn't even have to,
prepare
a suit
no.
against them?
No, we were ready to, mm-hmm. but we didn't have
mm-hmm.
to.
Mm-hmm.
Bar.
Were you able to use the U of L Law School library at
yes.
that time?
Yes, could have used U of L.
So with the U of L, then you prepared a suit, but you didn't have to?
Didn't have to file it.
Mm-hmm. Was there any issue with the Louisville Municipal College faculty?
Well, the NAACP was, and I as a member, and as one of the lawyers, I guess I just was sort of a go-along fellow, but I know that there were issues, but not that we handled from a legal viewpoint. Okay. More, I don't know, they took Dr. Parrish, and they took Dr. Wilson, and
mm-hmm.
one or two other good professors,
mm-hmm. mm-hmm. and the rest of them.
And the rest of them went somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Speaking of the hospitals, I've read a few flyers, really, about something called the Interracial Hospital Movement. It was an effort to get the hospitals integrated. Were you involved in that, or do you remember that? Mm,
I don't remember exactly what that was.
Okay.
I wonder who put out those flyers.
Well, I saw them in the Braden papers.
Oh,
so that was something
okay.
that I know that Ann Braden and a woman whose name I don't remember, Barnett, something Barnett, had organized. But it was a
okay.
statewide thing.
Oh, all right. Mm-hmm. Well, they were active on a lot of mm-hmm. fronts. And mm-hmm. when you asked me that a minute ago whether there were others involved, I don't know that I should have mentioned
mm-hmm.
some of them. There were groups, of course,
mm-hmm.
working for integration, the Braden group particularly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you already asked about the legal strategy, so all this leading up to, what about the school desegregation in Louisville? Once Brown happens, what did
mm-hmm.
the local NAACP do at that point? What was the reaction to Brown, and what did they plan to do about it?
Well, of course, you know, what happened was that they filed the action in the federal district court here in Judge Gordon.
Mm-hmm.
The Judge Gordon's orders were those that were followed here,
mm-hmm.
and
okay.
he's the one who determined the judge. What's Judge Gordon's first name? I can't remember. But Judge. mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay.
And it was Judge Gordon's orders mm-hmm. that had to be followed around here.
Okay.
And, he determined the percentages of how many blacks would have to be bused to,
yeah, that's,
and all that
yeah,
sort of thing, you
yeah,
know, that
yeah.
the burden of busing fell on blacks, of course.
Right, of course, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Don't know very much about busing yet.
No.
Mm, yeah.
Uh-huh.
But what about...
I think
yeah.
busing was fairly successful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, There are some complaints now by some of these people who say, well, why can't more of us go to Central High School and
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing, and I don't know how they're going to work that out, but
mm-hmm.
Central it has a good program. Have you been over there?
I've seen it.
They have an excellent program
mm-hmm.
now.
Mm-hmm.
And they're working in the downtown. Well, they also... You see, they're working with the business community, the legal community, the medical community, and these kids are getting all kinds of exposure as
little summer internships.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
They have the business on the school campus.
Mm-hmm.
They got a Kentucky Fried Chicken there.
Oh, really?
That they run.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and and one or two other businesses, which
mm-hmm.
they actually run.
Mm-hmm.
And with their connection with the downtown business, it's a wonder to me that there aren't more whites who want to go to that school.
Mm-hmm.
There were earlier. I
mm-hmm.
don't know. Maybe it's... I'm just surprised.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know.
But because more whites don't go, we can't get the blacks in who would like to go because it would upset the balance.
Right. The percentages. Right. I know. I've been trying to follow all that now.
Yeah.
All the stuff that's going on now. One thing I needed to clarify from the last interview that we did is the positions you've had. So in the early 50s, you're doing this legal work for the NAACP.
Mm-hmm.
When does that stop?
When I became an assistant commerce attorney.
Which was? Here's a benchmark. Was it before the Wade House incident?
No.
No, it was after that.
No,
when you became my assistant commerce attorney.
I was there.
Okay,
When the Wades,
mm-hmm.
I was an assistant commerce attorney.
So you're already in the job by then?
Okay. Yes, when the Wade incident occurred.
Okay.
And I think I hadn't been there more than maybe a year or two.
Okay, all right.
I was an assistant commerce attorney about 7 years.
Wow.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Under...
Hamilton. Mm-hmm.
And...
I don't know
Larry,
who comes after Hamilton.
Larry Higgins. Larry Higgins.
Okay.
Hamilton
okay.
and Higgins.
Okay. So that would have been then, if you were in the job...
Not at the beginning of Hamilton's,
mm-hmm.
Hamilton was, I think it's, did Hamilton have two terms?
He must have, he was in there awful long.
He was there a long time.
Like 8 years.
He may have had two terms,
yeah.
But I was not with him in the beginning,
mm-hmm.
but I was there during the entire period of Larry Higgins,
mm-hmm.
I guess it's a 6-year term, maybe
mm-hmm.
six years.
How did you get that job?
Through political activity,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and they recognized that I was a pretty good trial lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Truthfully,
I
handled some pretty good cases, and,
mm-hmm.
Then I got through Johnny Crimmins and Miss Lenny
mm-hmm.
McLaughlin,
mm-hmm.
working in the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I got recommended, and it was automatic. When they said it, that's why I said that we had political bosses.
Mm-hmm.
The boss said, you'll do so-and-so, Scott Hamilton, you'll take Howard Ben Shope, and he did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what were your responsibilities in that job?
They were a general. I was not put into a segregated, I was a prosecutor. And I
mm-hmm.
prosecuted cases generally, and I, under Larry Higgins, I prosecuted more serious cases. Under Scott Hamilton, as I was developing into, I was Higgins, I became Higgins' chief prosecutor, but I was
mm-hmm.
not chief prosecutor when Hamilton was there.
Okay.
But I developed.
Mm-hmm.
By the time Higgins came along, I was really a hot shot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow.
I prosecuted his murder cases and his...
Really?
Yeah, and his... that he didn't try himself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he liked to try cases.
Mm-hmm.
Higgins did.
Mm-hmm.
Hamilton
mm-hmm.
didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But I would try his serious cases.
Mm-hmm. Did you enjoy that job?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I did.
Mm-hmm.
I really did enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What did you do next?
Ran for judge.
Okay.
Became judge of the old Louisville Police Court.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I accepted an appointment as trial commissioner when Neville Tucker was the judge
okay.
of the police court, and I accepted a position of trial commissioner. And then when he got in trouble and left, I ran for and became the judge of the Louisville Police Court.
Okay.
That's in 1973. I can pinpoint that date.
Okay.
And then in about 3 or 4 years later, I was appointed to the circuit court bench.
Mm-hmm.
It's 3 or 4, 2 or 3.
So that's an appointed position.
Appointed.
The circuit court is appointed.
I was appointed to fill a vacancy.
Oh, okay.
And then had to run.
Okay.
Had to run at the next election. So I ran Judge Hayes. Judge Hayes became a judge in the new Court of Appeals, which was established in 1975.
Mm.
And when he took that position, I was appointed to fill the vacancy. Mm. After which I had to run the next year.
Mm.
And for the balance of his term.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then ran again for an additional
term
of mm-hmm. my own.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, let's see, that would be 75, I guess, when I first... 75? No, it wasn't 75. It's been
73.
Wait a minute, Bob. Wait, when I first... Well, I was a judge of the police court in 73. Right? Come here, your memory's better than mine. 73?
Never ran in 67. You stayed with him. And you were the first lower police court judge in the Hall of Justice. You ran in 1975
for the circuit court bench. No. Go ahead.
Her memory's better. Let her talk.
Yeah. I believe it was 73 or 74. Andrew was born in 73.
Okay. Every
and
time there's an election, Barbara's
she was a baby. She was a baby.
Okay.
Okay. And that election was either 74 or 75. That's when you ran the first time. Then you ran again for the 8-year term.
Well, but you forget, I didn't have to run originally because I was appointed
no,
to fill
I know
the
you
vacancy.
Were, I know you were appointed to fill the vacancy.
Okay.
And you...
Then I had to run for the balance of his,
of
Mr. Of Hayes'
term.
Term.
Mm-hmm.
See,
you
when
came
they,
out in 91.
92.
That was an 8-year term, so go backwards.
That was January of 82, so I guess you could call it 80.
No.
Of 92. 8 years before that would be 84, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so 84.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
So you ran in 83.
83, yeah, that
See?
Makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
So a series of...
And then before that, it was John Hayes's
mm-hmm.
6 years before
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
6 years before 80. What do we go back to? 83?
83. So six years
would
be 76.
76.
Right. Okay.
That's right.
So these are...
Hayes ran 76. He left when they established the new court. I became a judge over there in 77.
Charlene
I was appointed to the bench.
Yeah.
I was appointed to the bench in 77. I'm glad
exactly.
you remember.
But these are a series of first appointed under the Scottie Hamilton and that, and then elected judge positions.
That's right.
Right. Okay.
All the judge positions are elected, but you get a they fill a vacancy by an appointment.
Mm-hmm. And then you have to run to keep it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And in these positions. So when we talked before, it was my sense that after you became under Scottie Hamilton, that your role in the legal work for the NAACP had to end or chose to end?
Well, I guess I could retain a membership and
mm-hmm.
you know, was consulted, but as a lawyer, I was no longer available to sue the city or sue the state, you know, and those, I couldn't do that.
You couldn't do that.
No.
It's a conflict of interest.
Right.
Right. Okay.
So that ended my...
Okay. So were you able to stay involved in civil rights work on any level after that?
Only as a member, supporting
mm-hmm.
member, and that's about all.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's about all. I was consulted by lawyers when they were going to do something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But other than that,
so the
they picked me up and I was out of it.
Mm-hmm. Well then, I wanted to ask you some questions that are sort of reflections on the movement as a whole type questions.
Right.
First, I did want to ask, I know about Deanna, obviously, because I've interviewed her, but was there anyone else in your family involved in civil rights activity, either spouses or children?
Not as much. Deanna was, let's see, I think, and I'm trying to wonder why Carol was not, why my daughter, who is a police officer, was not involved. And I can only think that she probably was away in school.
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems to me she would have been, and the others were probably too young.
Yeah, because Deanna's first thing. She was in high school, so Carol's right. younger than her, right?
Carol's younger. Carol would have been. All the others are younger.
Yeah, yeah. So
I think it's the age.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And I'm sure that Norma was not involved.
No, no.
No.
Okay.
So. Yeah. That's it.
Okay. Just you and Deanna?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure about that. And one general question is, if you were writing this book and someone said, when did the movement start? When did civil rights activity start and when did it end in Louisville? Or when did the movement start and end in Louisville? What would you say?
Well, you know, I'd say that the movement has more than one beginning because we probably have to go back to the days of the I. Willis Coles and the days of Buchanan versus Worley and things that people were doing before I was thought of, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm.
But if you talk about the Latter Day movement,
mm-hmm.
I think it began with the push for fair housing.
Public housing in the 50s or open housing in the 60s?
Open housing in the 60s, I think.
Okay.
Well, that's too late. You have to go back to the integration of schools because you have to go back into the 50s.
Mm-hmm. So there may be waves of it.
Waves. I think it's waves. I think it dies down for a while and then somebody says, well, we're not doing this.
What about when did it end?
It's not over.
Okay.
It's still going on.
Mm-hmm.
To a lesser degree, of course, because we're still not satisfied that we have equal employment opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
Those things are difficult to judge.
Mm-hmm.
Any problems that we have today, they're very subtle and no outrageous, outright public discriminations.
Mm-hmm.
And of course you can't gauge what individual action is. You usually just gauge a public
mm-hmm.
action.
Mm-hmm.
Equality of opportunity depends more upon attitudes, I believe. And attitudes, I believe, are being changed as we have integrated education and other activities.
Mm-hmm.
I believe people are beginning to know each other.
Mm-hmm.
And when you know folks, you like them better.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really to our advantage.
Mm-hmm.
And in the long run, I think that's what will help us more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
We become appreciative of our neighbors as we get to know them,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
not as we stand apart from them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it's still some work to do.
Okay. How would you say over the time that you've been either, you know, participating on your own in legal work or observing it as a judge and as a father, how would you say the movement changed over time?
Okay. All right. Oh yeah, it changed the public. The official attitude has changed.
Mm-hmm.
Because the official attitude was segregation now, segregation forever,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the official attitude has changed completely to a point where you can really expect most mayors and governors and county judges to support advantages for all people.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have the opposition in the leadership roles that we used to have.
Mm-hmm.
We can expect that most big corporations realize that they can be more productive if their workforce is diversified.
Mm-hmm.
And that there is a market for their goods among all people.
Mm-hmm.
So that over the years, these acknowledgments have caused a great change.
Mm-hmm.
to where there is no longer a question of whether it's, whether it's just right wrong, but a question of why not? In other words, we look to see if there are any disadvantages rather than to see what are the advantages of segregation, but are there any disadvantages to integration? And we're not really finding any. There are certain things that bother us. We are worried about the number of blacks, young blacks, who are disenfranchised by virtue of the fact that they've gotten into some sort of trouble. And Kentucky is one of the states where you can be permanently disenfranchised for committing a felony. So that my latest reading is that about there's a procedure by which your civil rights can be restored, but it's not just an automatic thing. And since the black population has had its share of trouble, and blacks have perhaps disproportionately been convicted of crime, the disenfranchisement is a very serious problem, particularly when we only have a few people who want to vote anyway. And then of the few who want to vote, if a great number of them are disenfranchised because of having been convicted, we have, I've forgotten what that figure is, but there is a figure about it. I think at least 15% of black eligible men cannot vote. That's a big percentage.
Those, I didn't know that.
And my understanding is that that's not a very big percentage when compared to some of the other states. That the figure goes almost up to 50% in some states.
Oh my gosh.
So when we talk about just being unable to vote, this is something that I think future generations of people are going to have to give their attention to. At least some of these people, I've seen people who've changed. You know, they say, well, you can't be rehabilitated. Once a criminal, always a criminal. But I've seen too many people who've been, maybe they've just gotten too old and don't want to commit crime anymore. But they, for one reason or another, they've become rehabilitated to an extent. And we're still making efforts to rehabilitate people. So I, to an extent that I think we ought to
consider that's an issue.
Ought to do something about that.
That's interesting. Because one of the questions I have is, what are continuing issues?
That's one. That's one.
And that is jobs. Issue. What you were saying before is another
right
one.
Jobs. And drugs. I don't know where we go with that. I don't know where we go with that drug problem. Anytime a kid can get out here on the street and make $150 a day, or $200 or $300 a day,
there's an attraction there.
There's an attraction.
So those are issues that.
Well, the issues within the black community, which the black community needs to address, as well as addressing it from a community-wide viewpoint.
That's interesting. One question I have is again, these are sort of kind of reflective questions.
Sure.
In the past, or during, over the time period, you know, from when you got here, I guess, through current, what do you consider to be the most significant moments or breakthroughs in terms of civil rights activity in Louisville? What would you say were the highlights of civil rights activity in Louisville?
Well, of course, it'd be statewide, but I'd say the victory in the Lyman Johnson case, integrating higher education, and as well as the integration of the elementary and
secondary schools.
Schools.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the real highlights.
Mm-hmm.
Politically, the election of a third of the members of the Board of Aldermen who are black, that's a
fairly big thing.
That's a big thing. They mm-hmm. they influence city policy. And
there have been blacks on the Board of Aldermen since the 30s?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, they have been.
Always, continually, at least one?
I don't remember a time that there wasn't
okay.
one. Ed Clayton's father was the first one. Clayton was the first that I remember. He was here when he was on the board when I came, and he was a Republican. Edward Clayton Sr., I believe, was his name. And then after that, you had, most of them were Republicans. You had Louise Reynolds, and you had...
Because someone had the name wrong and told me it was Russell Lee. So it's George.
No.
Separate people?
Wait a minute. Yeah, they are separate people.
Oh, okay.
But Russell is the right one.
Oh, okay.
George was his brother.
Oh, okay. Okay, so it is Russell Lee.
Russell Lee
okay.
was Russell Lee.
On the Board of Aldermen.
On the Board of Aldermen,
okay.
Right.
So there have always been blacks on the Board of Aldermen?
At least one.
Has there, someone asked me this the other day and I didn't know the answer. Has there ever been a poll tax in Louisville?
Yeah, yes, but not in my time.
Okay, so it's gone by the time you got here.
By the time I got here, poll okay. tax was gone.
Okay.
Yeah.
I need to find out when it went away.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Kentucky had a poll tax.
Okay, gone by. So that would be gone by 1946.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes, indeed.
Okay. What role do you think black political activity played in civil rights activity here?
Oh, I think without blacks actively spearheading the movement, things would have... probably, you know, just languished. And perhaps someday some things would have occurred. But blacks had to have the activists who stir things up and keep it going. And blacks were prominent in that area. They had their white supporters.
Mm-hmm.
And without the white supporters, they probably couldn't have gotten very far.
What was the extent of white support for the movement here in Louisville?
I think... primarily, I really give great credit to the newspaper.
Really?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Why is that?
I think we had a very liberal newspaper, which kept things before the people, and editorial positions were taken which were favorable to black progress.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think that was extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think the fact that we had a black press, which at that time was read, well read among blacks, and not as much now as it was then.
Mm-hmm.
And black press with very good writers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And an active NAACP, an active urban league, which really didn't come into the civil rights area so as much as NAACP until later.
Okay. Any other organizations you can think of that were important even for a short period of time?
Well, Pride, George Burney's Pride
okay. mm-hmm.
Group. Eubanks Tucker had a group. He called it the Kentucky...
I was going to ask you about it, the Kentucky Bureau for Negro Affairs.
Right.
What was that all
That's
about? What do you know about them?
I think it was more a paper organization than anything else, but it was Eubanks Tucker's way to express himself.
Okay.
Now, he probably had a few associates, but
mm-hmm.
I think it was largely his organization.
Okay.
Uh-huh. As I think Pride is largely George Burney's organization.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think they have a lot of people working with them, but I think they use the vehicle.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because I've seen the name occasionally.
Yeah. That was Eubanks Tucker. And I'm speaking of the time that now he was here before I was here, so if he had more activity earlier, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
since I've been here, that was Eubanks Tucker.
Okay. And it seems to me it was founded at one point and then nothing for years and then sort of revived. Or started
mm-hmm.
showing up in the papers
yeah,
again. And it would have been founded before you were here.
Yes.
Because I think it's like 41 or 42.
Yes.
But then revived, I think 53 seems to be.
Okay.
Where I find a lot of
okay.
Stuff, so that would make sense. What was the, these aren't in any particular order, just things
mm-hmm.
that come ahead,
sure.
the relationship between the Louisville movement and activists and national or regional? kind of connections did you have between, say, with the national organization or with national movement?
Mm-hmm. Well, in each instance, when we prepared cases that the NAACP was involved in, we brought in the national, well, at least if we didn't bring them, we consulted with national NAACP headquarters and their lawyers. We had Thurgood Marshall, of course, was here, and Frank mm-hmm. Williams, and Bob Carter, who later became a federal judge up in New York, and
mm-hmm.
and Constance Motley, mm-hmm. who is now, I believe, a federal judge mm-hmm. in New York, if she has not retired.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And some of the professors from Harvard, I mean from Howard
yeah.
University
mm-hmm.
Law School.
Mm-hmm.
So that we had a pretty good network as far as the bringing the legal cases were concerned.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we had the advantage of their experience as well as some of their failures,
mm-hmm.
some
mm-hmm.
of their successes and failures, and perhaps the reasons for their failures.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it helped us to prepare our matters here.
Mm-hmm.
And on occasions, they actually appeared with us. You know, they would come and appear.
Actually, in the courtroom.
In the courtroom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that you say you have local counsel, but you also have national support.
Mm-hmm.
And that did not cost the local chapter. That was paid for by national support of NAACP, so it didn't cost a local
Oh,
chapter.
That's good. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That was really a big help.
Mm-hmm.
You get the guy down who's been teaching the civil rights at Howard and to be one of your lawyers,
mm-hmm.
and he doesn't cost you anything.
Mm-hmm. How did the judges react to that?
Federal judges didn't seem to look upon outsiders as troublemakers,
mm-hmm.
but the state court judge did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, you could tell the state court judges didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
You could really tell that.
Bringing in the big gun.
Bringing in the big
yeah.
gun, yeah. Oh, yeah, state court judges did not like it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think it affected the outcome that you had these other people there?
I think the down to University of Kentucky that it well it made it more dramatic, but the outcome it just seems to me there's no other outcome that could have occurred.
Mm-hmm.
When you go down there and you say you file Lyman Johnson's lawsuit against University of Kentucky, you say Lyman Johnson wants graduate education, you don't provide it for blacks in Kentucky. Yet you
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You want to prove that, you know, under the Equal Protections Clause of the United States Constitution, that you're given equal consideration to all your citizens. Judge H. Church Ford says, well, the burden is on the state to show that they do provide equal opportunity for blacks. There's nothing to be proved, really.
Mm-hmm.
But you bring in the big wheels, you get local support.
Mm-hmm.
Get local support from blacks.
Oh.
Get local black support when you bring in the big wheels. That's
mm-hmm.
when, if you need some money,
uh-huh.
and you need membership,
mm-hmm.
then
mm-hmm.
you bring in Thurgood Marshall
mm-hmm.
or Jim Neighbort, who is at the time was the dean of Howard Law School. You bring him down, and they participate.
Mm-hmm.
So, so I guess. But how could the result have been any different?
Right.
I don't think the result could possibly have
mm-hmm.
been any different.
Mm-hmm. But it makes it popular with the local.
Absolutely.
Brings in members and...
Absolutely. We got support.
Oh, that's interesting. How did Louisville compare to other cities in terms of civil rights activity?
Louisville was not as difficult to... as some of the cities who were farther south, of course,
mm-hmm.
we didn't have dogs attacking people and hoses,
mm-hmm.
hose pipes,
mm-hmm.
hosing people down
mm-hmm.
or any serious trouble that Only the marches out there when Martin Luther King Jr. came and they marched in South Louisville on the housing area. I understand there was perhaps a rock or two thrown. In fact, he got hit.
Yeah.
But things were so much worse in other cities. I think Louisville was more ready to accept the fact that it was inevitable that all people are going to be equal under the law, and relationships, I don't think, have been bad here since that time as a result of it. I think we got some more to do. I better not say we're in great shape. I can't say that.
Well, it's always better. It can always get better.
Sure,
right?
That's right.
Yeah. One question I had, and I meant to ask this earlier and I forgot, but it's a question that I'm trying to pinpoint a lot of people, historians, talk about. You know, when you talked about the political groups trying to make things better within segregation, that you knew you couldn't confront segregation, when does the switch come from improving things within segregation to attacking segregation itself?
I have heard that discussed, and I believe the push came from a white philanthropist, really, who told the national NAACP leaders that you're going about this
the wrong way.
The wrong way. Hit it head on. Now, let me see if I can remember who that's supposed to have been. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, do you remember when that idea gets to Louisville?
Yeah. It got here really in the 50s
mm-hmm.
cases.
Mm-hmm.
But, and we included it in our lawsuits.
Right.
But we just didn't do any good with it. We didn't push it.
Yeah. Yeah,
included, but didn't, which we didn't expect any results from it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the fact that it could be accomplished began to be developed on the national scale when they started including historians like the Dr. John Hope Franklin,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And to get expert witnesses before the court so that we could develop a case with witnesses
mm-hmm.
who would, for some reason, build a case which shows that segregation is in and of itself a discriminatory practice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when they started getting these expert witnesses together, and we had expert witnesses ready to testify in our case, again, in the Lyman Johnson case, but didn't have to have it because the federal judge said it's burdens on Kentucky to prove.
It
made it much simpler for
uh-huh.
us. But when they got these expert witnesses together, and psychologists and educators,
mm-hmm.
historians who testified, and there was no testimony to the contrary, that these circumstances produce an inequality,
mm-hmm.
inherently so, then and all of that was a part of what was, they finally came to the conclusion based upon the, I wish I could really know who started
that. Not the national?
I can't name the individual, you know.
Yeah.
I know Roy Wilkins was still there,
mm-hmm.
and I know Thurgood Marshall was there,
mm-hmm.
but there were whites who said you're not doing it right.
Yeah, that probably would have been in the 30s, I would think.
Probably so. Yeah. Said you're just not hitting it hard enough. You know, you're mm-hmm. going about it, you're hitting around the edges. You're succeeding because
mm-hmm.
they won all the cases because all the time it was an obvious discrimination.
Right.
Obvious where the state provided one thing for one group of citizens it didn't provide for others.
Mm-hmm.
So it was easy to win those cases. But to go to the heart of it, it needed some impetus that which it did not have until
mm-hmm.
somebody.
Well, I can probably find that in a book on the end of the national level stuff,
yeah.
But it's the Louisville stuff that you can't find in the books, you know.
You can't hardly find anybody who worked any harder around here than Lyman Johnson.
I need to read the book about him.
Yeah, Johnson.
Again, I read it once, but mm-hmm. I have to read it again.
Johnson worked. In fact, when I was in law school away from here, I was reading about Johnson trying to equalize teachers' salaries. Mm-hmm. You know, salaries weren't equalized.
Mm-hmm.
I read about Johnson and something he did down in where was it, Columbia, Tennessee, or somewhere where he came, wherever it was
That's
he came
from. Right?
That's where
he's from,
right?
Yeah.
And then I was glad to meet him because he, while I was in law school, he came to Ann Arbor during the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And
took summer classes. Is that what he was doing?
He was there,
okay.
Taking some doing some graduate work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether I was in law school during the summer or whether I was just working, but I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And met him. In fact, I don't think I was taking summer classes that summer. I think I was just trying to get some money.
Mm-hmm. Trying to make some money.
Trying to survive.
So, because he was very much a leader.
Yes.
Right, well, even by the time you got back here.
He certainly was.
So some of the leaders you mentioned, James Crumlin, Alfred Carroll.
They were here,
Anderson.
Too.
Okay.
Yeah.
All these people were the
Anderson
the 1940s leaders, you could say.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Just make that, you know, because one thing is I like looking at how the generations of leaders change.
Mm-hmm,
Well, you know, one kind of similar question to the generations of leaders changing is it seems to me you all are working on legal work in the 50s, but that kind of seems to slow down. So how did tactics of the
Well, I'm trying to wonder what else there was to do legally.
Yeah, because after Brown...
After Brown and after everything else, as far as the integration of public facilities and everything was concerned, that's all done.
Mm-hmm.
Then you had to get into the, we talk about housing, employment, education.
Those seem to be the big ones that are. Because busing would count under education.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So those things were, when you cleared those things up, then almost everything else becomes a matter of a private activity.
Mm-hmm.
I did say employment, didn't I?
Yeah, you
did. Yeah, because that was a big one.
How did the Human Relations Commission get set up? Because that seems to be, that would have been
the local,
yeah,
local Human Relations Commission. That was, I think that was under the Calgar administration.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And it started as a result of the Fair Housing Ordinance was passed, I believe, first.
No, Open Accommodations was first.
Was it first?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Well, it was it about the same time?
Open accommodations is like 63. Open housing is 67.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay, and was
open accommodations maybe a little earlier.
Well, it was all when during that entire time, yeah. Judge Calgar was the
mayor,
was he not?
Mm-hmm.
And where was the push? No, and the alderman. I was mayor.
Well, I can look it up.
I don't know. Yeah. I'm sorry.
It's a little later, and it's then it's once you're. I think you're probably in the Commonwealth Attorney's office.
I am.
That time,
I'm eating at the public trough.
Yeah. So.
I don't pay attention anymore.
So last kind of question is. These earlier years, then you're talking like from when you get here to when you get on the Commonwealth Attorney. Is there anything else in that period that you think is important that I should know about? Because that's really early, and there's not very much written about it.
Mm-hmm.
Anything about the kinds of strategies you used or the kinds of activities that were going on that I've not asked about?
Well, I told you about the political clubs, and we talked about.
They seem real interesting.
And
you said you didn't know anything about the Democratic Club because you were a Republican at the time.
That's right.
Okay, but did you join the Democratic Club once you became a Democrat?
I surely did.
Okay.
I surely did. And,
okay.
And in fact, when I'm with my second wife, Barbara was a member of the, at one time she was one of the legislative district people
mm-hmm.
up there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, and I was president of the 12th Ward Democratic Club.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
When was that? Must have been before you were Commonwealth
Assistant. Yeah, it had to be before I...
Yeah.
It's when I changed politics, but it was before I became assistant Commonwealth Attorney, so I wasn't
so
there very
early
long.
Early 50s, probably.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's interesting.
So, mm-hmm. I'm a dyed-in-the-wool, you know, mm-hmm. lifelong.
I'm a lifelong Democrat. I was never a Republican. So those seem to be pretty important.
I think so.
Those things. Did African American community here pay any attention to the Henry Wallace, the 1948 Progressive Party campaign at all?
There were a few. Not too much, really.
Mm-hmm.
Not too much. I don't know why, but not too much.
Pretty much stuck with the Democrats or the Republicans?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I'm trying to remember if they had a leader here, locally. I don't remember anybody leading the campaign for Henry Wallace.
Locally. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know the unions were sort of interested,
mm-hmm.
but I don't know besides that. Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, that was my last question.
Okay.